Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar. Today, August 25th, 2026, we are delighted to host a conversation entitled Academic Freedom and the First Amendment, Who Decides What Is Taught? My name is Emma Blakemore, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I will keep our introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Joe Cohn, Tyson Langhofer, and Mae Mailman as our panelists, with Casey Maddox serving as our moderator. Mr. Cohn is a research scholar in law at Yale Law School and executive director of the Center for Academic Freedom and Free Speech. Mr. Langhofer serves as senior counsel on Alliance Defending Freedom's Center for Free Speech. Ms. Mailman is a former senior White House official, and Mr. Maddox is vice president for legal strategy at Stand Together. And I will leave it there. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, we ask that you please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. And with that, thank you for being with us today. And I will turn things over to Mr. Maddox to start the conversation.
Great. Thanks, Emma. Thanks to FedSoc for hosting this conversation. So I was just saying to the panelists that I believe three of the four of us have actually had the words academic freedom at some point in our titles. And yet there is this open question about what exactly does academic freedom mean? So it's a term that we use frequently, but I think there's a lot less, and the Supreme Court has been very adamant about the importance of academic freedom in very large language, and yet specifically what exactly it means and how it fits with the First Amendment has been an open question. Academic freedom arguably predates the First Amendment by almost six centuries. In 1229, after a dispute involving students escalated with violence and several students were killed by people sent by the government, teachers at the University of Paris did something that will sound surprisingly modern. They went on strike. And they suspended teaching and left the city at that point. And after 2 years, Pope Gregory IX intervened with a papal bull, Parens Scientiarum, which I'm probably butchering as a Protestant, so my apologies. But it literally means the mother of sciences. And this is thought of as, sometimes thought of as the Magna Carta of both the University of Paris and of Western universities generally, and sort of the beginning of a concept of academic freedom in Western universities. Among other things, it limited authority of the university chancellor, recognized the university's ability to make rules governing its own affairs, and protected scholars against abuses by government officials. Now, we should be careful not, of course, to turn Pope Gregory IX into some 13th century civil libertarian. All of this was within the context of the Catholic Church, and he had the ability to still impose theological boundaries on what was taught at the University of Paris. But it is interesting in the sense that it's sort of the beginning of this understanding of the university having some sort of structure of authority that's separate from the civil authorities. And that remarkably sounds a lot like the argument that we're continuing to have today. Who has academic freedom? Is it the professor? Is it the university? Is it the students? And when we're talking about a public university, where exactly does the state fit into this and the taxpayers fit in? After all, it's the state that created the public university in the first place. It created it, it funds it, it continues to hire the faculty. Appoint the trustees. All of these are involved in some sort of a political process. And so how exactly do these things work together? Two very recent cases have explored this question, and we're going to begin the conversation sort of through the lens of those two Court of Appeals decisions that have recently come down in just the last couple of months. The first is Purnell versus Florida State University System. You may know this case as the Stop Woke Act case. This is an 11th Circuit decision by Judge Britt Grant that involved Florida's Stop Woke Act. And some portions of that act were not actually subject to this decision, the portions dealing with the K-12 process and in other contexts. The university portion, the higher ed part, was what came up to the 11th Circuit most recently. Florida's law prohibited professors at public universities from instruction that, quote, espouses, promotes, advances, inculcates, or compels students to believe 8 specified concepts concerning race and sex. Professors remain free to discuss those ideas objectively in the classroom, and certainly they were free to criticize them, which may be important, but they couldn't endorse those concepts in the classroom. Florida defended the law with a pretty straightforward argument that's intuitive, I think, to a lot of people. These professors are state employees. The classroom is part of their job, and the state is entitled to decide what its employees are going to teach. The 11th Circuit rejected that argument. The majority refused to extend the Garcetti decision, which we'll talk about some as we go on, refused to extend it categorically to university teaching and rejected the idea that everything a public professor says in the classroom simply becomes government speech subject to control by the authorities. Universities retained substantial authority, the court said, over curriculum and pedagogy, and that doesn't give the legislature an unlimited power to prohibit professors from expressing selected viewpoints. So just a little over a week ago, the 7th Circuit weighed in McDonald versus Trustees of Indiana University. Indiana statute approaches the same sort of issue, but almost from the opposite direction, or arguably from the opposite direction. Rather than forbidding professors from endorsing a particular set of views, what Indiana did was to require public universities to consider whether for tenure and for pay of faculty, to consider whether professors were fostering free inquiry, expression, and intellectual diversity, whether they exposed students to scholarly works from a variety of political or ideological perspectives, and whether they refrained from injecting political views unrelated to their courses. Several professors said that those requirements caused them to change the way that they taught, that violated the First Amendment, and they challenged that law. The 7th Circuit didn't actually decide, at least a majority of the 7th Circuit didn't actually decide that First Amendment question. Instead, they decided to dismiss the case on standing grounds, saying that the professors had not yet shown a credible threat that what they wanted to teach would actually be impacted by this law. But the court left open the possibility that a different enforcement record could lead to a justiciable case later on. And Judge Easterbrook wrote separately, arguing that professors have this concept of academic freedom backwards, that these professors had that concept backwards. In his view, the academic freedom principally belongs to the university as an institution, not to individual faculty members. And a university has to be able to decide what will be taught, who will teach it, and how its educational program will be structured. And the state legislature is responsible for the university. And so that flows to them to make those decisions. His wonderfully provocative formulation is that the professor's classroom speech, quote, has not been regulated, it has been hired. And that obviously sets up this this seeming conflict, at least between Judge Easterbrook and the panel, the 11th Circuit panel in Purnell. If academic freedom means creating a sphere insulated from political orthodoxy, who are we insulating from whom? Is it the professor from the university? Is it the university from the legislature? Is it the student from the professor? Or somehow all three of those at the same time? So perhaps that question that we've been trying to solve for about 800 years, we can answer all of your questions here on this panel. I'm excited to talk to these three folks. I will begin first with Joe, because Joe, his entire job is academic freedom at Yale, right? So surely you know the answer to this question. Joe, what exactly is academic freedom? How does it work in the First Amendment?
Well, I appreciate you kicking off today with such a softball question. I had planned on answering it with an elaborate and really kick-ass Napoleon Dynamite-style interpretive dance, but given the format instead, what I think I'm going to do is just, you know, go back to discussing it through the lens of what the courts have said over the years. And it starts in my mind with the 1957 case of Sweezy versus New Hampshire. And I'm going to try not to do too many just like long quotes of opinions, but I think it's really, you know, a good one to anchor the conversation. And I'm also going to give a second quote, you know, from the concurrence there, because I think it really will tee off the conversation nicely. So from the majority opinion, the court says the essentiality of freedom in the community of American universities is almost self-evident. No one should underestimate the vital role in a democracy that's played by those who guide and train our youth. To impose any straitjacket upon the intellectual leaders in our colleges and universities would imperil the future of our nation. No field of education is so thoroughly comprehended by man that new discoveries cannot yet be made. Particularly that is true in the social sciences, where few, if any, principles are accepted as absolutes. Teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study, and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, our civilization will stagnate and die. So I think that's, you know, how the majority view, and that's how, at least in American law, you start seeing constitutionally the concept of academic freedom take root. To me, I think it's a mistake to kind of phrase this as who owns all of the academic freedom, as if there aren't multiple contexts of things going on at universities. So you have classroom teaching, you have research and scholarship, you have all of the other vibrant kind of events that take place on a campus where people learn and debate and discuss things. And in all of these ways, different entities have different, you have private and public institutions. So the crib note answer to me, which I think will be fleshed out a little bit when I go quickly into Frankfurt's concurrence and then throw it back to others, is that different stakeholders have different interests and have final say at different aspects of this question. So let's go to Frankfurt's concurrence before I weigh in on how I divvy it up, and I'll do that as quickly as I can. Frankfurt in the concurrence in Sweezy says, a university is characterized by the spirit of free inquiry, its ideal being the ideal of Socrates, to follow the argument where it leads. This implies the right to examine, question, modify, or reject traditional ideas and beliefs. Dogma and hypothesis are incompatible, and the concept of an immutable doctrine is repugnant to the spirit of a university. It is the business of a university to provide that atmosphere which is most conducive to speculation, experimentation, creation. It's an atmosphere in which there prevail the four essential freedoms of a university to determine for itself on the academic grounds who may teach, what may be taught, how it shall be taught, and who may be admitted to study. So at least in Frankfurt's concurrence, it's clear that some of it is reserved for the university. And Sweezy itself stands for the proposition that government's ability to control and establish an orthodoxy is limited. And if it was true that the faculty had no academic freedom rights of their own, then they would never prevail against their institutions as employers on constitutional grounds, but they have repeatedly throughout history too. So I'll leave it there and let others kind of jump in.
Well, maybe I'll come to Tyson next on this. Tyson, if you obviously, you know, at ADF, a lot of the work on academic freedom was both faculty members represented. It was both faculty members and students, right? Was sort of principally the two areas. So if you have a circumstance where a professor wants to teach X, a university administration says not X, and the state legislature says Y, and maybe this is going to be too complex of a question, you have to figure out the algebra. But you've got conflicting information between the three of them on what they want to do. Who wins that fight? And how does academic freedom sort of inform that question?
Well, that's a great question. I think obviously that's sums up the entire debate we're talking about here, right? Because as Joe noted, and as you noted, there are multiple, organizations, individuals, representative groups that all have an interest in promoting the education of the next generation. And in some way, they all have some version of academic freedom. And where that balancing lies, I think, is what these courts are grappling with, right? Because obviously the state does have an interest because it spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year in educating the next generation. And in it, you know, we have an interest as a state to be able to make sure that our students are equipped to take on, you know, these challenges. At the same time, we also know, as Joe indicated, that the Supreme Court has noted over and over again that when the state tries to specifically regulate everything that's said in a classroom, it's going to cast a pall of orthodoxy over that classroom and maybe even limit the learning. So I think that there is a balance in here that every one of those entities and individuals actually have an interest. The state, I think, is pretty clear. They have the right to dictate the kind of the breadth of the curriculum in general. We're going to fund these things and kind of here's the curriculum. And then these individual institutions have the ability to determine, you know, what does that look like, right? What, you know, individually, what are the classes and things like that? And who do we hire? But professors have the right to then determine how are we going to actually deliver that. And I think what these cases are dealing with is there some right that either the state or the university has to dictate specifically what a professor can or cannot say in any individual class? And I think, you know, that is going to vary. But what we've seen with these cases, like with the 11th Circuit case in Purnell, is they're saying, look, maybe there is some right somewhere. But what we know, at least 11th Circuit says, is the state itself cannot come in and say entire swaths of debatable ideas are off limits. That's what Purnell stands for. And you know, the Seventh Circuit, again, is dealing with a different situation. You know, can they evaluate professors based upon some criteria upon which the state says these are good things for professors to have, right? And that's a separate question. And I think, you know, that's something that the Supreme Court has not yet weighed in on those two particular issues. And I think those are issues that are going to continue to percolate until the Supreme Court weighs in.
All right, so May, you get this decision in Purnell, 2-1 decision. Judge Lagoa in the dissent, you have Britt Grant in writing the majority, both of which have been sort of, you know, often thought of as champions of the sort of the conservative legal movement tradition, and judges that were, I think, believe both appointed by President Trump. So you have this, it's not a sort of right-left fight in that sense. But how do you sort of process this Purnell decision, and especially the role of the state legislature and the taxpayers in Florida in making these decisions about how, like, what they want taught in Florida universities?
Yeah. So every once in a while, you read a decision that you just feel allergic to, like a Bostock, maybe, where you have an emotional reaction. That for me was the Purnell decision and Britt Grant's writing here, because I could find nothing discernible about the First Amendment in it, but I felt a lot of judge-made authority where they basically acknowledge that, of course, the state can set some boundaries, but just not this particular boundary. And that's been, I think, the trend of the First Amendment, is giving judges more and more say and less about Congress shall make no law. So academic freedom, if I'm thinking about it, and if I look at what the Trump administration proposed in negotiated rulemaking of what academic freedom means, they did say it's owned by the faculty. So this was not adopted in the proposed reg, but it was proposed in the negotiation process. So academic freedom is the freedom of faculty to do all these things, conduct research, whatever. But because academic may be owned by the faculty does not necessarily make it a First Amendment right, and certainly not a super First Amendment right. So academic freedom may be good. It may be a democratic good. It may be the right policy. But if faculty own some sort of right, then, you know, you could say, I would like to teach that life begins at birth. I'd like to teach that at, you know, fill in the blank college. And no, that college doesn't have to hire you, but that's not because of where the academic freedom right lies. It's that there are things that are more important than your policy of academic freedom in certain circumstances. And that is, for some, the First Amendment right of the university, the First Amendment right of the state to be able to fund and say the things that it wants. And so here, the state doesn't have to fund anything. The whole point of land grant universities, of getting into this business, wasn't like, hey, I'd like to give some money to some liberal professors to go have a good time. That was not the point of it. The point was, I'd like engineering, I'd like agriculture research, I'd like military research. I'm going to fund certain projects. And so when the universities and when the state and the state as universities have their right to speak, that can't mean nothing. And so reading this opinion made me think Hillsdale might as well just take the federal money, because if taking the federal money still gives faculty their full, like if it doesn't come with some right that the state has, then you might as well have your cake and eat it too. But the reason I found Lagoa's dissent and Florida's argument compelling is I think it's a clearer line, but also it acknowledges, and I just want to read it does not. So the First Amendment protects all viewpoints in the public square, whether they are conventional or controversial, but it does not compel all viewpoints to be worthy of state-sponsored endorsement. And things like certain races are morally superior to other races are not worthy of state-sponsored endorsement.
So I think there's two questions here I want to pull on, and we can. Whoever wants to take some of these, feel free to jump in now that we've sort of set the table. I think there's two questions that occur to me immediately. One is the degree to which the Purnell decision is fundamentally a viewpoint discrimination question, right? Does the decision come out differently? The majority perceives of the rule in as of the Stop Woke Act is basically saying, not that you can't teach certain topics, but when you're teaching those topics, this is the view that needs to be expressed and not the other view, right? So to what degree is it we're talking about academic freedom, but it's really just a standard issue viewpoint discrimination case, and that's really the only thing that's happening here. And then the second question is around Garcetti. Let's begin with the first one, though, and then we'll come to the Garcetti question in a moment. And I'm curious, Joe, if you've got thoughts on the viewpoint element and whether that really sort of controlled here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the viewpoint element has to be a really central factor of the analysis, because you have to go back to what the Supreme Court has said about this. And you have Keesian versus Board of Curators, the 1967, case. And, they say that our nation is deeply committed to safeguarding academic freedom, which is of transcendent value to all of us and not merely to the teachers concerned. And it goes on to say that the freedom is therefore a special concern of the First Amendment in particular. So here they're referencing expressly the First Amendment, and says, which does not tolerate laws that cast a pall of orthodoxy under the classroom. And it's really hard to think of something that would be, this isn't even adjacent to that. This is directly on point, You may not express a viewpoint that the government disfavors. And I think the problem, is, a little bit of short-sightedness and not seeing that the government shifts hands, faculty over, where you have to come up with rules that are evergreen and not look at just the moment and say that if the government had the ability to say, we dislike this idea, it must not be expressed by a faculty member at a public university, then why even have public universities? I mean, this is not K-12. You're not talking about a captive audience. Every adult chose to be there. And, really, I think if you believe that and higher education is about the search for truth, which was rooted in both the opinion and the concurrence in Sweezy, then you have to have the room to disagree with the government in the classroom as a First Amendment right, specifically when viewpoints are targeted.
Man, do you have a
thoughts, I guess, there in response, this idea that the necessity of the professor being able to have the ability to disagree with the government in the classroom as opposed to elsewhere.
Yeah, I guess that the consequence, well, then the government may as well not be in the business of universities, isn't so scary to me. I mean, the first 100 years of our nation did not have that practice, right? So I think it would be different if the government was coming in and saying to these private universities, not taking federal money, you know, Hillsdale, Harvard, that predated the country by 100 years. Here's what you can teach. Here's what you can do. That starts to get Congress shall make no law in, like, not that is the core. You can't do that. But when the government comes in and says, you know what, I'd like to participate in this process. I'd like to fund some things. I would like for our kids to learn how to do ag. I'd like for our kids to learn how to build some robots. And so I'm going to fund that. And you know what we're not going to do? We're not going to fund a sort of doomerism anti-robot. This is going to be a pro-robot school, that they should be able to have a pro-robot school. Now, is that maybe the search for truth? Is the truth that robots are bad and that we should all be doomers? Maybe. But I think once the government is in this business, to tell them that now you can't, there's a superseding right to your rights to have a pro-robot school. And that superseding right is academic freedom. I just don't find that. It might be in Supreme Court opinions that, you know, post-date our Constitution and our founding. I don't find that idea of a superseding academic freedom right, which may well be good for the country. But I think that the government should have a right to have a pro-robot school.
So I guess this, I'll come to you, Tyson, on this, because I think this sets up the Garcetti question. The rule that I think May is basically describing there is more or less sort of how it works in other government contexts under Garcetti, right? Government says, look, we're hiring people to say things. You can't take the opposite position and say the opposite thing. Sometimes you just can't say stuff that would be embarrassing to the government, for that matter. As a government employee, your free speech rights aren't quite the same. And so what the Garcetti decision does is to basically sort of give public employees sort of a lesser free speech right as a consequence of their employment, and allows their government employer to be able to give some conditions on what they can say. That's not necessarily the way that, and the Supreme Court that's a Supreme Court decision in Garcetti, and Tyson, you can clean it up for me. But that's not been the rule with universities so far. So Tyson, if you can speak to that and sort of what the special kind of status at this point of universities is after the Garcetti decision.
Sure, absolutely. I think that's a great segue. I mean, so historically, you've got the court applied the Pickering balancing test to employee speech and whether the government can punish or censor employees for engaging in speech. And they, looked at this balancing test of, is it, on a matter of public concern? And if it is, then you're going to balance the interests, the rights of the employee to speak their free speech rights with the interests of the government to deliver efficiently the services that it's delivering. But in the Garcetti decision, the Supreme Court looked at a situation with a public employee and said that when an employee is speaking pursuant to his official duties, then there are no free speech rights at all. So kind of came in with this new categorical, line that says pursuant to official duties, no rights. But, in response to a dissent said, we're not deciding whether this applies to public university professors when engaged in teaching or scholarship. So there's this question out there after Garcetti, teaching and scholarship. Does Garcetti apply or does it not? every circuit court, I believe, that has addressed this issue has said that Garcetti does not apply to professors when engaged in teaching and scholarship. And that we litigated a case, the Meriwether case, on this particular issue. And I think it actually is a good example of addressing the tension that kind of May and Joe are talking about here. And I'll tell you, so we'll talk about why. So the facts there in the Meriwether case was Professor Meriwether was a longtime tenured professor at Shawnee State University. He taught religion and philosophy, and in a philosophy class in 2018, a student came up after class and a male student asked for Dr. Meriwether to refer to him as a female. And Dr. Meriwether said, I don't think I can do that. But, you know, we can work on, you know, addressing you in a way that, that doesn't offend you. And essentially, what he wanted to do was address the student using a last name and avoid pronouns. And he was even willing to use the new name that the student requested, the feminine name. The university held that he had violated the Title IX rights of this student by refusing to use the pronouns this student demanded. And the Sixth Circuit reversed the school's decision and essentially held that Garcetti doesn't apply and that you're going to balance these rights here. And I think what the Sixth Circuit held there, I think, is important. They held several different things. One, they said that when engaged in core academic functions, professors of public universities have First Amendment rights. And they said that academic freedom exception covers all classroom speech related to matters of public concern, whether it's germane to the contents of the lecture or not. We've all went to college. We all know that there are, you know, non-germane issues discussed all the time. And many times professors are expressing their opinion on that. And here the Sixth Circuit saying, look, they have to express it if it's a matter of public concern, you know, even if it's not germane to the lecture. And so the other thing that they held that I think is important is they held that both the professors have academic freedom rights as well as the universities. And they held that the public concern, analysis is the same as the academic freedom concern. It's the same character. They're doing that kind of a same analysis there. So I think what Meriwether, as I look at it, what it basically held was, look, the university has the ability to determine what its curriculum is. And if it wants to take a kind of pro-gender ideology approach to it, it can do that. But what it can't do is compel a professor to affirm personally his agreement with that through the use of these pronouns, and that there is some right that a professor has when in a classroom speaking on a matter of public concern that the university cannot compel a professor in that context to agree with the orthodoxy being promoted by the university. So the university can, and the state does have an interest in promoting its speech and its views on certain topics, but it can't compel professors, even in classrooms, to personally affirm those beliefs. So that's kind of what Meriwether did. Now, that doesn't settle all of the issues, right? It doesn't settle the broader Purnell issues. Can it ban all of that? But it does say that there is some. We recognize that when teaching, there is both kind of government speech, which is the curricular aspect, and some personal speech. Now, the personal speech can obviously begin to impact and undermine the government speech. And at some point when it does that, the university does have the right to remove that professor. But it can't say you can't ever give a personal opinion which disagrees with this curricular choice of the university.
Can I jump in really quickly? I want to just say a couple things about, you know, Meriwether, because I think Meriwether is a really, you know, good example of what illustrates a concept that I really think is important, which is don't fall in love with the club that will be used to beat you over the head. Indoctrination is either right or it is wrong. And it can be wielded by either side because people in power tend to censor who they disagree with. And in this instance, you had in Meriwether, you had a professor that did not want to parrot what their bosses were saying. It didn't matter that the boss was the university itself or whether the boss was from the legislature or the government. There was a right to not be forced you know, to say certain things in that context. Now, that being said, I agree with May on part of her argument, though, which is, you know, if the university, if the state wants to say we're creating a dental school and they found a dental school and then the dental school stops teaching dentistry, they have the right to say, like, geez, what are we doing here? But once you start opening liberal arts, and liberal arts includes just like the way you kind of debate and understand truth, that's where you get into, that's where you get into this whole discussion of what it means for the government to be hands off, to give breathing room for those, you know, for those solid debates. And that's why, you know, each of the circuits, the Ninth Circuit's in Demers, Kilbourn versus Almeridas in the Seventh Circuit, Adams in the Fourth Circuit, you know, Parnell and Novoa in the First Circuit, Second Circuit, you have Heim versus Daniel, which is actually an interesting one that cuts a little bit the other direction, where an economics professor who is Keyesian wanted to, you know, sued over being passed for tenure. And the court agrees that there has to be a Garcetti exception, but also says that the university can decide that it wants its economics department to teach a particular, you know, point of view. And if it wants to be, you know, this kind of economics department, it can be. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. I didn't mean to take too much of a detour there, but
yeah,
I want to pass over May.
I mean, I just think that once you get into a judge balancing the professor's rights versus the state's issues, both the state and the professor, like, there's even less freedom because now it's judicial fiat, like the judge wins. And so if you wanted to have your cake and eat it too, and have there be able to be governments and be able to speak and have their own viewpoint and also have academic freedom, I think maybe at the end of the day, I'm just advocating for less government. So I think 77% of students go to a state public university. Maybe that's too high. Maybe it should be 75% of students who go to a non-government university, and then 25% are like training centers for our, that our government is funding, that have, they don't have the crazy majors that our country doesn't need, but they are set up as our land grant universities were supposed to be for certain paths, and they're preparing you to be critical thinkers. And sometimes that means you're going to have really diverse spaces where you go and you are exposed to lots of things. Some of them are going to be a little bit more narrow, but maybe that's the right balance. And where you then you have everything. You've got a group of universities that the state is not touching because they're not sponsoring. They can't argue that it's their viewpoint. Then you've got the universities that are the state that are able to speak. But to say that all professors carry this academic freedom right, kind of no matter where they go. And yes, maybe there's going to be some religious context. And that's when I think things get difficult. So even the Trump administration, when they were trying to define academic freedom, and I think one of the reasons why they did not decide to define academic freedom in the proposed rule, as they acknowledge in the proposed rule, is that if an institution has a religious mission, the agency would evaluate whether the institution maintains academic freedom protections consistent with its religious mission. So I think, you know, things start to get uneasy about how much the government is then assessing your consistency with your own religious mission. And maybe the real solution is just a flip of what the government is invested in the higher ed context.
So we do have several questions that that are in the Q&A already. Several very good questions. So please put them there if you have not already. I'm going to ask one or two more, and then we're going to come to the questions over there. So, I think the let's get maybe into a little bit of prognostication. Supreme Court left this question open, like faculty free speech rights in Garcetti. It expressly left the question open. The court has changed since it did that, and the lower courts, I think. Check me if I'm wrong, but I think the lower courts have have consistently come down on the side of saying, well, we're not going to apply Garcetti in this context to faculty members. If this question gets up to the Supreme Court, so maybe kind of quick answers among the three of you. Do you have a prognostication on how you think the court is going to address that question, or if it's frankly going to do something like May is suggesting and try to sort of open up the question a bit broader than where we are right now? But we'll begin with Tyson. If you had to guess, this question gets up to the court on faculty and Garcetti and how does it apply? What do you think the court does?
Well, I mean, I think given the unanimity of the circuit courts so far on this question, I think it is hard to. I would think that the balance lies in the favor of Garcetti not applying that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't some additional state right to determine certain curriculums and things like that, and control, as May was talking about, how the universities, you know, are carry out their mission. Right. They do have the ability to determine that in some ways. But I don't think those are mutually exclusive. So bottom line is I think it would likely rule that Garcetti does not apply if I had to, you know, make a prediction.
Joe, if you had to guess.
I'm not usually.
Dance is fine here. If you want to do
I'm
that,
I'm not usually in the predicting the Supreme Court, you know, business. But I think that the trend in the courts. I also just think that you can't be at all consistent with the content of Apollo Orthodoxy if the government can outright ban ideas. I do think that they'll be permissive, like, because there are other people who want the government to be involved 0% at all. And I don't think the court's going to adopt that view. I don't think they're going to say that the government can't say that we want civic centers or we want, you know, everyone who graduates to take, you know, civics classes, for example. So I think that they'll allow some involvement, but I don't think that they'll ever allow bans of ideas outright.
May,
what's your guess?
Anything, but I guess if we're moving toward a more like text history and tradition idea of the First Amendment, it's going to require like a blowing up of the First Amendment probably. And maybe one step to that could be recognizing that judge-made balancing tests in the First Amendment are not a good idea. And at least some clear line drawing.
Yeah, I do think that is, and in fairness, I do think that is it's an important point that you're making, that when you the Pickering test applied to faculty speech just gets you to this strange sort of weighing the balance between the government and the professor. There's not a lot of clarity in exactly how that's going to work out. Even what is a matter of public concern, for example, there's a lot that's left to the judge in this context to make these sorts of decisions, and that's the protective. Sort of perceived as the protective First Amendment version, but is protective First Amendment, and it's ultimately left with a vote of 9 judges to make that determination. So it is sort of an uncomfortable spot that we're in. Okay, we're going to go to some of these questions that are in the chat. One points out, so we've talked a few times here about this sort of concern in the case law about a pall of orthodoxy being cast upon the classroom. So I think the anonymous person who's asking the question is basically asking, like, what do we do when when there is a pall of orthodoxy, but the pall of orthodoxy is not necessarily coming from the government itself? Right. If there just is a pall of orthodoxy, then now what do we do? Right. Is there a responsibility of the state legislature to actually step in and try to make the pall of orthodoxy less of a thing? This might get you back to, you know, questions around the McDonald decision from the Seventh Circuit, where I think that's sort of exactly what they're trying to solve for there. Right. The perception from the state legislature is, well, we do have a pall of orthodoxy. And we've got a faculty that seems to all be heading in one direction, and we want people to actually expose people to more ideas. So how do we think about this sort of the problem of a pall of orthodoxy being cast upon the classroom when when it's not the result of the government, it's the government trying to sort of solve that problem?
I think it's a great question. And I think that is exactly why we see states trying to take certain action here, because they know, and almost everybody recognizes, there is a pall of orthodoxy in our public university classrooms. There's no doubt about that. All the polls show that, you know, when you look at professors' leanings and so forth. And so there is a pall of orthodoxy, and the states are trying to address that. And they're experimenting. How do we do that? And how do we do that within the confines of the First Amendment? Because I think everybody, in general recognizes that we need to be able to discuss these issues and have debate on these issues. And when we suppress debate, you know, we're not doing our students a disservice. We're doing our students a disservice, and we can't educate them well. So how to reverse that trend without violating the First Amendment? I think there are many different ways that you can potentially accomplish that. May brought up a few, you know, like how do we, you know, move things from all public or, you know, majority public university to private universities and so forth. And I think doing some policy, some policy choices around that might be one way to do it. But I think it's necessary, and universities are going to have to recognize this and start taking some action to address it. Otherwise, states are going to do it. And we've heard universities discussing this, but I haven't seen many of them actually taking action to address the ideological imbalance. And if they're not willing to do it, then there are going to be other, you know, states coming in and doing it. And obviously universities don't like it when they do that.
Yeah. I mean, addressing the, you know, viewpoint diversity problems on universities is, I think, one of the greatest challenges for higher education, because there aren't any silver bullet easy fixes. Just real quickly on the litigation in Indiana, it was tossed on standing grounds. I don't know if I agree with the opinion. I really don't. There are parts of that statute that I think were really good and helpful. But it also just did things where the problem was, in my opinion, vagueness, not what it was trying to do, but it was saying, hey, you're going to be evaluated based on whether or not you are likely, not whether or not you have, whether or not you are likely to introduce, matters that aren't germane, for example. And how do you, like, if you're a professor and you're going through your career trying to build towards tenure with standards that are that broad and vague and unpredictable to do that, except to steer anywhere clear of the thing, like a mile away from the things that could upset the apple cart of whomever will ultimately be making that decision. But I agree with Tyson almost every word that he said about, like, the experimentation that's going to be happening in state legislatures. One thing I would say is that the lower hanging fruit is, I don't think anyone objects to legislatures adding more voices to the mix. I mean, there are people who have objected, but I think they're few and far between, and that is not the mainstream, you know, arguments.
So I'm going to go to Sarah Field's question. Sarah's asking, there's this problem of perceived scientific agreement. So basically, when you have state legislatures jumping into these kinds of questions, right, and this isn't just in the university context, it's can be more broadly. But very often the issue is, I'll ask it as she asked it. You have perceived scientific agreement on contentious issues, climate change, COVID, transgender treatment, being deemed misinformation or warranting inoculation from the institution. But scientific progress often depends on challenging orthodoxies, even the ones that even everybody on this call would agree, like, well, that's certain, right? Now you've got a faculty member who is challenging those orthodoxies, right? So it can both be true that everyone looks at that person and thinks, well, that's crazy. And at the same time, we would acknowledge that, well, it's important that someone continue to be the person who is taking a different position on this, because we've seen what happens when everybody agrees throughout history. That usually leads you to bad positions. So how do we address this consensus question? How should it address inform legal standards? Like, to what degree is it relevant that there is a consensus on a particular scientific or other question? And what role the legislature or the university has in telling faculty, we're now taking this question off the table. You can't, you know, say the earth is flat, for example.
Well, I mean,
hey, I'll come to you on this, actually. You have thoughts on this. Does that sort of consensus matter?
I think obviously consensus has to matter. You don't have to. I don't think it should be mandated by either the Constitution or academic freedom or vibes or whatever that is, that you have to hire as the widest range of crazy people that are out there. So, you know, that said, I think, does the MMR vaccine cause autism? Every scientific study right now does not have a clear link, but obviously you should still be able to study that question, and even tough questions about race or sex, or, you know, I think for a long time you were not able to challenge that, what we're allowed to say on women and men existing, you couldn't even say a few years ago. So, yes, like, consensus, I think, should matter. But I think it's an Overton window question. And I think that's why the word cancel culture sometimes gets confusing, because, you guys said you're against cancel culture. It's like, no, cancel culture is when you take something that's within the Overton window that you can debate and you say it's outside, like you treat a normal opinion as if it's cancelable, but there is and has to be an Overton window.
So, you know, this is a really kind of complicated question in a number of ways, but I think one thing that's helpful is to break down parts of it. Again, which is, like, there's difference between research and teaching in the classroom, you know, as well. Whereas with research, it's exceptionally important that even the bad ideas aren't censored, or the ones that we as a society think are bad ideas, because sometimes ultimately they prove true after scrutiny. So you want, you know, your research outlets to be places where, you know, where things can be debated fiercely. And, you know, there's real challenges when journals view things too narrow-mindedly to publish things that go against the grain. But we also happen to live in a world where the internet exists so that ideas can still at least get out there in other formats, you know, too, as one at least small silver lining counterbalance. There has to be some ability for institutions to decide, and the way we do it, you know, currently is you have, you know, people in a particular field deciding, you know, together what establishes certain competencies. And it's true that they might be wrong, right? There was a time in which everyone thought the earth was flat, and that was the consensus, and we needed people to be able to say, nope, it ain't. So I'm not trying to make the argument that the consensus is always right. But if the university can't say that, you know, we don't want someone teaching that the earth is flat in our, you know, earth science, you know, department, then they run the risk of their own credibility, you know, as well. So currently it's imperfect, but we do it by having departments kind of debate what those competencies are. And the third ingredient, I know this may make you cringe, but I think it's actually a positive thing, which is you have robust courts where litigators like Tyson can go in and say there's an individual right to make this argument, to be the dissenter, to be the gadfly, et cetera. And it's that great check and balance that the First Amendment is supposed to put on the majority to say, hey, we have this individual right to sometimes speak. And that's why there has to be some element of individual freedom as part of academic freedom in some of these contexts.
So we have another question here. What does the panel make of the primacy of protecting political speech in educational spaces as urged by Judge Thapar and Nalbandian and Judge Bush also? How do we measure that against state interest? So basically, like, The degree to which we want to treat political speech as sort of particularly important and more protected. So do we want to think in sort of those categories? Does that help or complicate the analysis?
I mean, I don't know that it complicates the analysis because, frankly, it's almost always that is at issue in these cases that are being debated. I mean, these are typically matters of public concern, usually, not always, but usually. And so because those are the ones that, you know, that the public cares about. So I do think that it matters that the distinction between a private employment dispute and a public concern, you know, I think that is a legitimate distinction that courts should take into account when addressing this. And especially when we're talking about, again, a professor who is teaching a course and somebody says, hey, what do you think about this issue? And he expresses his opinion and is and censored for that. Obviously, that is a core to what our First Amendment protects, the ability for individuals to express something on a topic that's really important and that actually matters outside of the context of the classroom.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead, Meg.
I was going to say, I don't necessarily disagree that And I went to Harvard, so I don't know the First Amendment. So I will say
that's a great quote. I'm going to pull that quote. That's a fantastic quote. So go ahead.
I think they taught this. I don't know if this is good that they taught this or not, but that the First Amendment was an onion, and that in the center of the onion was the political speech, and on the outside is like torn, right? And so the closer you got. And I don't necessarily disagree that there are certain things that you just don't think of as speech, like porn and commercial speech or whatever. And so I guess the core of that question is whether there's, you know, like political speech is at the core of it, which it is, and therefore whether it should have a more stringent test. I think sometimes the problem is this is a pronouns case, Parents Defending Education, or was case.
Ola Tangi.
Yeah. That sometimes there's a labeling issue. So, all right, should I call pronouns a religious issue? Should I call them a political issue? Should I call them a scientific issue because men and women do exist? And so I wouldn't want to get into the space where the same exact thing, pronouns, get more or less deference based on whether we think of that as religious, political, or scientific.
I think go ahead, Joe.
I just, one of the reasons why it's broken down so often in that way is because, you know, how crucial it is to a democracy to be able to debate the issues that are important to how we'll function. So whatever issue it is, whether it's scientific or not, if it's the core of what we are politically arguing about in debates with politicians, et cetera, and in policies, there's inherently a political element, whether it's, you know, whether the topic is sexual or scientific or medical or artistic. If we're debating what the rules are around it, you know, with government entities setting things that are binding and punishable potentially, that's the political element of it in that particular context. And, you know, courts are hesitant, you know, to allow government restrictions on how we can debate the world we want to live in.
Yeah, I think this is the, in my view, the real trick, right? Is that in a theoretically, in a world in which, it was 1781 again, and we were limiting Congress to these are the eight things that you're responsible for. And sort of the things that we thought of as political were a lot more limited to that universe of things. As it is now, you could almost play a parlor game, right? It would be pretty easy to take any question and turn it into something political. College sports is now political. It would be difficult to sort of just limit it there, I think. This has been a fantastic conversation. I'm sure that all of our listeners will agree that After 800 years, we have solved this question. We've answered all the questions around academic freedom. Thank you, all of you, for participating in this conversation. And again, to FedSoc for hosting us as well. So thank you, Emma.
Thanks, Casey. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. I also want to thank you, our audience, for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback, if you have any, by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. As always, please keep an eye on our website and on your emails for any announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today, and we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.